You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, as the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues into its fourth month and the U.S. continues casting threats towards Iran and Syria, a growing number of people of Arab descent are calling for unity in their region of the world. Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with several Arab Americans about what that unity means and what it's based on. Her guests were Elias Rashnawi and Michelle Shahadeh, spokespeople for Free Palestine Alliance.
This is an attempt to unite the Arab American community in the United States around certain positions, progressive positions, in regard to U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Arab world and vis-a-vis the events happening in Israel-Palestine.
Now, in terms of the principles that you are organizing around, can you talk a little bit about what the principles of this call for pan-Arab unity are?
These principles are to basically reject the attempts to impose military solutions and to impose positions that promote colonialism, that promote militarism, that basically a rejection of the doctrines of the Bush administration of using the military might of the United States for political reasons and to basically use military power to impose regimes, to impose solutions, to impose ways in the Arab world that further the interest of the Bush administration of using the resources of the Arab world towards its own interest rather than the interest of the Arab people.
We do have Elias Rashnawi on the line right now, and he is also a spokesperson for the Free Palestine Alliance. So following on what Michelle was saying, this, the way in which the Bush administration is essentially using the resources of the Arab world to effectively colonize or occupy the Arab world, can you just explain along your lines as well how that is an important principle of this call for pan-Arab unity?
This call is not unique in the sense that it is only coming from activists in the United States. There are calls right now throughout the Arab world. There are calls in Europe. There are calls mirroring this exact call and have been inspired by what you have seen in this call for pan-Arab unity. And the reason this is the case is because Arabs throughout feel that they have become, in fact, victimized, not only in the sense of robbing their resources, but also they have forced to become partners in a system of servitude that, in fact, is being imposed, as Michelle just said, by the Bush administration and others that cooperate or others that partner with the Bush and with the Bush administration in terms of victimizing the Arab world. And Arab unity and the emergence of a consensus says that we do not accept in any shape or form any sort of a solution, any sort of a program, any sort of a manifestation of a political understanding between entities that would place Palestinians, Arabs, Iraqis, wherever we may be. We do not accept any paradigms imposed on us by the movement. For instance, let's take the United States. We do not accept paradigms imposed on us by the movement in the United States that would serve the political expediency of the movement here. To give you an example, on the Palestinian issue, we do not accept that we as Arabs have to accept partial servitude and the reckon with a system of apartheid for the majority of our people and a system of slavery in that sense for a great number of our people and a system of destitution and exile for no less than 5.5 million of our people, simply so that the movement in the United States can say, well, we have catered to the Palestinians by saying, well, Israel, you must just end the occupation and bring down the wall of apartheid.
What do you mean by the movement exactly?
I'm talking about the peace movement, the justice movement that exists in the United States that is starting to understand that there is a very serious issue that must be addressed, and that is, for instance, the Palestinian issue, because that is the primary hurdle to globalization in the Middle East. It has become a symbolic struggle. It is very much like the struggles of the 60s and the 70s, like a Guevara, like the struggles in Africa that says, well, we must end the neo-colonial forms of slavery. And Arab Unity places the Palestinian struggle quite in that corner, that it is in fact a symbolic an inspiration for peoples everywhere, and that it embodies struggles and yearnings of people throughout.
I want to bring back Michelle Shahadeh, my other guest, on the situation here. When we're talking about pan-Arab unity, in practical terms, are you basically trying to put together a coalition of individuals who would be able to, in a sense, provide some counter or provide a strong lobby, if you will, to powerful groups in the U.S. As an anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist and pro-Arab movement?
This is basically an attempt to forge a position of individuals, organizations that represent the united Arab American community around certain positions on certain issues, and this consensus that will forge also a unity between the Arab American community and the movement of peace and justice and the anti-war movement. So this is not basically to establish another organization, if you will, that has certain position, but rather a consensus of a whole community.
What response have you gotten so far?
It is really amazing, the overwhelming support that this call for unity and this call for having a consensus and a position that will unite the community around, the overwhelming support and excitement and interest is beyond what we expected. And it seems that the community is now was waiting for such an initiative.
Going back to Elias, just thinking about the principles that you have laid out and some of the current events today, can you draw some comparison between what is happening today in the Arab world with the United States being the main power and what was happening in the Arab world with British and French occupation? Are we seeing history repeat itself? Because they too came with using the words of liberators and not occupiers.
You are correct. There is a great parallel between the two. However, during the time when the British and the French entered the Middle East as colonizers early this past century, there was at the same time a movement of decolonization immediately that has immediately emerged right after their entrance. Britain and France, when they colonized before, be it in Algeria, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine, Egypt, and the entire world, the entire Arab world, and much further, they did not realize during that time that a very strong and indigenous movement would arise that not only would reject their formulations, but also would reject their subsequent mechanisms. What we failed to do is to root out those mechanisms, although we rejected them, but we were never able to terminate them. So what you're seeing today is a continuation of the mechanisms that came from that era of colonization some 100 years ago. They remain, they are continuing, they serve as partners in this process of new colonization spearheaded by the unilateral and hyper-hegemonic force in the world, and that is the United States. But the counter, the antithesis to it, and that is us, the people, the masses everywhere, the grassroots movement, the democratic movements, have understood that clearly and are now articulating a vision that is very, very difficult to conquer, as was the case before.
Michelle Shahadeh, where can listeners read the entire call to pan-Arab unity? And if they themselves, if our Arab American listeners are interested in signing on, where can they send their signatures?
There is an email where they can, for their any questions or to get in touch with the people who are organizing this, an email which is a pan-Arab platform, PANARAB platform @yahoo.com. This is a way to get in touch of the organizers.
And they can request a copy of the text of this call for unity?
Yes.
Again, that's panarabplatform@yahoo.com. Michelle Shahade and Elias Rashnawi, thank you so much for joining us this morning. A brief excerpt from this call, just so you know a little bit about what it is it says, quote, "We call on the Arab American and Palestinian communities to resist all attempts to strip away our rights. We reject the strategic attempts to replace the unyielding demands of the Palestinian people in exile with a confused and opportunistic state-building model. We proclaim our resistance to political servitude and defeatist tendencies. We are certain that the collective Arab history of anti-colonialism, resistance, and struggle for liberation will surmount this challenge. We call on everyone to join together in formulating a pan-Arab consensus on issues from Palestinian liberation and ending the colonial occupation of Iraq to combating the war at home."
Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK, in Los Angeles, speaking about the concept of pan-Arab unity with Elias Rashnawi and Michelle Shahade, spokespeople for Free Palestine Alliance. A second rebel group launched an all-out assault today on President Charles Taylor's embattled forces in the southeastern port city of Buchanan, opening a new front in the civil war to oust the president. This as deliberations on a peace mission for the bloodiest West African nation showed no sign whatsoever of progress. The attack on Liberia's second largest city, the only significant port left in Taylor's hands, came as the nation's leading rebel movement, Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, pressed its 9-day-old siege of the capital, Monrovia, 60 miles to the west. Willie, a spokesperson for the leading rebel movement, is quoted by the Associated Press as saying, "Taylor must go," and saying only international whining about civilian casualties was stopping insurgents from a final push to topple the Liberian leader. "He's getting weaker and weaker," Wiley said. "He should not face us in a final military showdown that will just take lives." Rebel forces now hold more than 60% of Liberia, grinding down Taylor's forces in their 3-year battle to oust him. West African officials are meeting in Ghana, planning to send peacekeeping troops into Liberia later this week, while Swiss authorities have frozen bank accounts linked to the Liberian president, totaling $1.47 million. Peace Watch correspondent Ingrid Drake reports from the nation's capital how Liberians living in the U.S. want to exert their political pressure on the Bush administration.
Last night, more than 300 Liberians and their supporters gathered in front of the White House for a candlelight vigil. A majority of the participants were calling for an immediate deployment of U.S. troops in Liberia to provide a buffer zone between warring factions.
My name is Oliver Lloyd, Reverend Oliver Lloyd. We have congregated here today to try to draw the United States' attention much closer to the Liberian situation. We are happy that they have shown some concern, but we're looking for more action. Presently, there's close to 2,000 U.S. troops on sea. We're asking them to land, to get on shore, and bring this war to a stop.
My name is Rose Bernard. Primary reason I'm here is because poor people are suffering from this war. I have family back home that have become victims of this war, have been displaced, and then the family has been torn apart. Somehow, this has to stop. I mean, are we going to sit and just watch the country deteriorate and no one really step in? We don't have the political power, but, you know, America has intervened in Iran, Iraq. It would be nice if we can send some peacekeeping force somehow to sort it out, hopefully bring some kind of peace. The whole key is to find somebody who has the country at heart.
While many people spoke out about America's obligation to support Liberia, others raised the question of U.S. intervention in undermining African self-determination. Suzette Gardner, from the group Organized Community of United People, or Organized Q, said U.S. intervention will continue to disempower Liberians.
If the United States intervenes, it should do what is best for Liberians and not what the United States has done in the past. And so far we feel that Charles Taylor being in Liberia is a part of American interest because he really is the middleman of all these different businesses and corporations that are buying diamonds and shipping arms into that area, which continues, you know, the warfare that's going on right now. United States really is not supporting peace in Liberia. If the African Union is empowered, if ECOWAS is empowered, if What is Africa and the institutions which are, you know, coming together in Africa is empowered to really do the peacekeeping and exercise the diplomacy which is necessary to bring peace there, I think that would be a better solution. Right now, the United Nations and, of course, the United States put a lot of pressure on these groups, which limit what they can really do. If the United States is going to go into Liberia, it should be under a UN mandate. It should not be because, you know, people here are saying, please go. We definitely need the UN. We see that the United States has worked really hard to bring about the demise of the United Nations. And I think if the United States really don't want to see the demise of the United Nations, it should be a perfect opportunity for the U.S. to say, we want the UN to go in there under a UN mandate.
A Liberian graduate student who did not want to speak on the record because she feared her opinions as a young woman would not be valued by the dominant male leadership was disappointed that her people were begging the U.S. for assistance, especially during a time Liberians are celebrating their independence. The woman also said that most Liberians are educated to worship America and not taught to be critical of the U.S. involvement in the continent. As the group sang, prayed, and spoke out against the recent bombing that killed dozens of civilians, U.S. Park Police broke up the vigil. Frustrated and confused why the people would break up the peaceful protest, many in the group decided to march into the street and slow traffic. Police surrounded the group when they gathered in front of the Washington Post and threatened to arrest people if they failed to disperse and get out of the street. Some people believed the police were there to protect them. Others were pleased to see Liberians beginning to engage in civil disobedience.
That's a very good step by all Liberians to come out, demonstrate, put out a protest that people can come and the U.S. government can listen to our plight.
For Pacificus Peace Watch, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Activists concerned about the U.S. role in Liberia took their message to the White House last week in a rally calling for the president to send troops to that nation to stop the bloodshed.
And met in front of the White House. This was all impromptu.
We present to you, dear Lord, those who are displaced at home.
Stop the killing, the raping of our daughters, our mothers, our grandmothers, because there's no age limit to the raping and the mayhem.
Those who are sick and cannot get any medication, those who have been bulleted, bless everyone. Even those who are killing, we present them to you, Lord.
We are aware that America never does anything for nothing. But one thing, we are prepared to make the sacrifice for the sake of humanity. We know right now America is hesitant to go there because there is no particular American interest. There's nothing particular that they can gain.
So even the president of Liberia into your hand, because the hearts of the kings are in your hand, like a spring of water. So Jesus will submit them to you. Try to serve in hard hearts. Our hearts are bleeding.
We were in a meeting last night, and a small group rose up and said, why not forget about America? We're black. They will not be concerned about our interests. We're not just black, but we are Africans. They don't care about us. President Bush only used our situation as a publicity for his trip to Africa. And it's true. Since he came back, nothing has happened. He's not concerned, and we know that.
Come, send the Holy Spirit to wipe our tears. And we have come with your presence. We feel as a great martyr to you.
We're only trying to ask him and the American people to be a little more sensitive. We are sons and daughters of ex-slaves that helped to build this country. And over the years, our generations have always cherished that relationship and have always cherished the fact that we originated from America. And we're calling America to be committed to this relationship that we've always had.
Bless our effort and bring peace to Liberia. Let the honor and the glory not be given to any man or any nation on earth. Let it be yours and yours alone.
We will be coming here on a daily basis to march and create an awareness among those who don't know too much about Liberia, because many persons don't realize the tie between Liberia and the United States.
This is our prayer in Jesus' name.
Sounds from a rally of Liberian Americans held last week in front of the White House. Thanks to Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch's reporter from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, and Anthony Sloan for preparing that segment. with every attempt to get the Bush administration to intervene in the war in Liberia, the need for action is growing by the hour as more lives are destroyed. In her book, Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change, author Cynthia Kaufman takes us a step back from the day-to-day issues to gain an historical and theoretical perspective that allows forward movement with a comprehensive and realistic view of the world. Speaking recently with Peace Watch, Kaufman raised the issue of misconceptions and misinformation embedded in individuals that have stagnated efforts for positive social change. But she began by explaining the meaning of her book.
It's not a how-to book in that real narrow sense, you know, where it gives you little prescriptions and all of that. It's more of a stepping back book where you ask the bigger questions about why are we doing what we're doing and how do we understand the world, and then some stuff on organizing, kind of, you know, given what we want to change about the world, then how do we go about doing it.
What inspired you to write this book?
I've been teaching for about 20 years with the Count Graduate School, and I've been teaching about social justice issues, and I've been really amazed by how little there is that's directed towards young people or even towards older people who are just wanting to get involved in social justice work. So there's very little that introduces people to kind of the world of social justice activism mm-hmm. and the ideas behind it. I introduce the reader to a huge number of thinkers and activists and historical figures. So part of the idea behind the book is to get people wondering and wanting to read more.
Why is the World Bank, has it been targeted by individuals working for social justice for all the people in the world?
The issue with the World Bank is that it offers loans to Third World, Southern Hemisphere countries that are having economic problems. And in some ways, it looks like it's trying to help them out. And most of those countries feel like they have to take those loans because they're in just absolutely desperate financial situations. But the problem is the loans are offered on terms that make it so that really what ends up happening is that it makes it easier for businesses to operate in those countries. But unfortunately, it structures the relationship in such ways that it ends up being terrible for the people in those countries.
Exploitive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Africa being one of the main countries.
When you think about what's going on in the continent of Africa, it's just horrible. I mean, it's just really, truly horrible what the IMF does. And South Africa is such an interesting example, you know, where you have this, you know, incredible liberation movement, and the South African government has ended up making a lot of deals with the World Bank and IMF, and the living conditions for the poor of South Africa are in many ways worse than they were under apartheid. Because, what you have is, for example, a privatization of water, so you have and electricity. So people who live in small villages where the government, as terrible as it was, used to provide those things to people somewhat, now all of things have been privatized. So if you don't have money, you can't get electricity or water. And, of course, people don't have money.
You write that the dominant set of ideas that rule our society encourage us to have a passive view of our place in the world and a pessimistic view of the possibilities of change, suggesting that once we break free of this dominant set of ideas, a whole world of possibilities for changing the world opens up to us. Can you give us an example of one of these dominant beliefs? I know we've talked about some of them.
One of the dominant beliefs around that is that people never make a difference. You know, I think that so many people have a sense of our history in the U.S. that says, you know, that the powerful always win, that the people who try to make change are just a bunch of chumps and losers, sort of empty, starry-headed idealists. And another one is the idea that it's only sort of great individuals that make a difference. I could read a little passage on Rosa Parks.
Please do.
One of the things I think that makes us not believe that we can make a difference is the way the media often presents things like the civil rights movement as these sort of miraculous events that happened because of a couple great individuals came along, like Martin Luther King, and made it happen. So I've got a little passage. Let me just read this.
Mm-hmm.
We are encouraged to see history as being made by amazing individuals, by the inevitable flow of things, or by government action. The fact that ordinary people acting together achieve goals is a crucial part of the history of human society, is rarely a part of the picture that we're given. And yet, if we look at the positive changes that have been made in the recent past, almost all were the result of collective struggle. Women didn't just get the vote in modern electoral democracies when the time for it was inevitable. Rather, thousands of ordinary men and women who supported their cause in countries all around the world organized and agitated to get the vote. The elementary school version of the civil rights movement is that Martin Luther King Jr. made it all happen through the sheer force of his personal morality. What's too often left out is that King himself operated in the context of a broad popular movement made up of many ordinary people pushing for what they believed was right. The movement made King as much as King made the movement. We can see these distortions in the way that Rosa Parks' story is told. Many people learn in school that Rosa Parks was an African-American woman who was so tired coming home from work one day that she refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus to a white rider. She was jailed for her action, which led to a boycott of the bus system that lasted more than a year until segregated seating was abolished. What we aren't told is that Parks was an activist who had gone through organizer training at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, that she was a member of the NAACP, and that King and his organization were looking for a case to draw attention to the issue of segregation. While it wasn't especially uncommon for African Americans to resist giving up their seats, conflict over segregation happened all the time. What was special about Parks' case was that she was part of a movement to challenge segregation. Rosa Parks was not an amazing individual when she took her action. She was a person of conscience acting as part of a movement. When she refused to give up her seat, she didn't know how the situation would play itself out, but she knew she could count on the movement to back her up. When we're in the heat of a movement, we often don't know the importance of what we're doing. Partly that's because it really is unpredictable how our actions will add up to lasting social change, but also we lack the most basic information about how the actions of those working for change in the past have added up to many of the things we take for granted in our lives. And I go in on after that to talk about the 8-hour workday and how that came out of movements for social justice.
And I'm glad you pointed that example out, because that is one of the historical, I don't want to say myth, but misinformation around how that occurred. There was, in fact, a great deal of strategy, political strategy, involved in choosing Rosa Parks to be the one to actually to make that stand.
Exactly. And the story is always told like she was just so tired she couldn't stand it anymore.
Or make that sit.
That's right.
Now, what about the peace movement? It has been characterized as a superpower in view of what it was able to accomplish with this war in Iraq. I'd be interested in getting your analysis of that, because on the one hand, one can say, well, the war happened and some 6,000 Iraqis were killed. And 200. Nearly 200 American soldiers were killed.
Right.
So what did the peace movement accomplish?
It accomplished a tremendous amount, and it's so easy to forget that because, you know, one of the things it accomplished was that the U.S. government was planning to just go in and just bomb the hell out of that country. And although they bombed it severely and achieved some of their objectives, if it wasn't for the attention that was given to the situation because of the peace movement, because it was because of the peace movement that you had all that wrangling in the United Nations that went on for so long, and so many of the other countries of the world became active in their opposition to it. And I think that had a serious impact in cutting back the severity of the bombing, which meant that probably tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians were saved by the peace movement.
Cynthia Kaufman is the author of Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change. We'll continue our discussion with Kaufman tomorrow in part two of our interview. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA, Tiffany Jordan, Leonard Muyal, Shakia White, and Ingrid Drake. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.